Seabury Resources for Aging is a proud partner of Aging Matters. As a nonprofit, Seabury serves older adults in the Washington, D.C. region and across the United States with its care management model to support caregivers and their loved ones. Seabury is a pioneer in the field of services for older adults, providing affordable housing and support services to help older adults age in place. For more information, visit their website, seaburyresources.org, or call them at 202-289-5690. Hello and welcome to Aging Matters, a program featuring aging-related topics of interest to older adults and their families. I'm Cheryl Beversdorf, your host. Wellness is defined as the act of practicing healthy habits on a daily basis to attain better physical and mental health outcomes. One way to understand wellness is to consider health as a continuum that extends from illness to a state of optimal well-being. My guest today is Dr. Bill Rawls, leading expert in integrative health and author of a book called The Cellular Wellness Solution. He will talk about factors that promote wellness and how stress on our body cells affects the aging process and increases risk of chronic illness. He'll also describe how herbal therapy can promote healing when coupled with healthy lifestyle habits. So welcome, Dr. Rawls, and thank you for joining me today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Dr. Rawls, we want to find out a little bit more about what a book about cellular wellness solution has to do with older adults. So give us an overview. Why did you write it? And how, particularly, as I said, does it relate to older adults?
Every living organism is made of cells. Our body is made of cells. Everything that happens in our body is a function of cells, whether that's your heart beating, thyroid hormone being produced, skin and bones being repaired after an injury. It's all cellular. So when you look at the fact that cells do everything in the body, everything about wellness and oppositely of that, chronic illness and even aging, can be described in terms of cells. So when you focus on that cellular model, you're really getting to the root causes of what's happening in the body when we start to lose our health.
To that point, then, you've been talking about the wellness solution. Give us a little bit more information about wellness. I mentioned it in my introduction about the continuum between illness and optimal well-being. Explain exactly what that spectrum, where wellness is at one end and illness is at the other. What's in between? What do we need to know as far as our lives are concerned?
Well, you know, we're all somewhere on that spectrum, right? So not many of us are absolutely well, or we're only absolutely ill at the very end of our lives. So there is a big spectrum in between. If you wanted to define a best case scenario for wellness, somebody who's absolutely well or as close to it as possible, that would be someone around the age of 20 who has good health habits at that time. So through childhood, we're accumulating cells. Our body is being put together, and that reaches a peak at peak adulthood, which is around age 20. And at that point in time, we have 5 to 10 times more cells than we actually need to survive. So we have a lot of extras. And not only that, our cells are brand spanking new. They're all just freshly minted. So they're at the peak of their health. So it's not surprising that at age 20, we all felt pretty invincible. What aging is, how aging is defined from a cellular point of view, is that we gradually lose cells as time goes along. Now, this happens no matter what your health habits are. And it's a factor of the fact that our cells gradually run out of energy because we gradually burn out our mitochondria. And getting past that, overcoming that, would be breaking the physical laws of the universe. You just can't do it. So aging is inevitable, but chronic illness and having symptoms isn't necessarily inevitable. We lose cells because they lose energy. So when you look at someone at age 40, you know, most athletes are retired by age 40 because they're at that point, half their cellular reserves and their cells don't have as much energy. So even if they've had great health habits from age 20 to age 40, they're still reaching the end of their career because their cellular reserves are down and their functional energy capacity of their cells has diminished pretty significantly. By age 80, it's even half that. So, you know, cellular wellness is really important along those lines. So just because you're 80 doesn't mean that you are destined to have debilitating symptoms. So that really hit home to me because I lost my health around age 50 and had to regain it. And that's how I ended up looking at this cellular model. Now at age 67, though, I don't have symptoms and the health issues that I had when I was 50 because my health habits are good. I take good care of my cells. I'm aging. I've lost a lot of cells, but the cells I have are healthy. And that is the definition of wellness, is staying ahead of that curve, keeping your cells healthy.
And one thing that I noticed in your book, Dr. Walls, is you gave certain factors that can contribute to chronic illness. And it would be helpful for our listeners to talk about them. You mentioned poor diet, toxic environment. And then you also talked about different kinds of stress, mental, physical, and microbial. Talk about those different factors and how they promote illness and lead to chronic illness.
Looking at our cells. So each of our cells is like an independently functioning unit. So like a little microscopic machine that has a job. Different cells have different jobs, but structurally, they're basically all the same. Now, their internal machinery has been modified to do different jobs, but they're basically functionally the same. So when we look at that issue of cellular health, maintaining health, it's really about taking care of our cells and avoiding stress. So how do we define stress? Well, we define stress by what our cells need to function to be healthy. Not our whole body, because our whole body is made of cells. If you take care of one cell, you take care of all cells in the body. And I started looking at this a long time ago. The first book I wrote was like 15 or 20 years ago for my patients. And I was starting to look at this idea that stress factors are associated with chronic illness. 20 years ago, doctors weren't looking at that at all. But then we started saying, well, diet and toxins in the environment and not getting sleep and all of these things. Well, it gets right back to the cells. To be healthy, cells need five things. And that's it. They need the right nutrients. Now, that varies. It's like thyroid cells need iodine to make thyroid hormone. Heart cells burn mainly fat to generate energy. But if you're eating a well-rounded whole food diet, which is a whole cell diet, you're giving the cells all they need. Cells need a clean environment. Little microscopic machines, if they're contaminants, it's like throwing sand in the machinery. And that goes for natural toxins like mycotoxins, but also all the environmental things that we're exposed to that come from the chemical and petroleum industries. You know, that's saturated our environment. It affects cellular functions. It hobbles them. The cells don't work as well. They have to use more energy. They burn out faster. So that's a big issue. Number three, cells need downtime to recover from stress. Some cells, like our heart cells, have to rest in between beats. That's why our heart cells are so vulnerable. But most of our cells, we need that good 8 hours of sleep at night. And if we're not getting that, average in America is 6.5 hours. So if you're only getting 6.5 hours of sleep at night, you're starting your next day with a cellular deficit. Your cells haven't recovered from the day before. So cells need downtime, really important. And in our hyped up modern world, We don't always get that. Cells need good blood flow, really important, to deliver nutrients and oxygen and wash away toxic substances. We need, you know, we got to have flow. We got to, our cells have to be constantly bathed in fluid. And that comes from being physically active. There's a lot of benefits to being physically active, but one of the biggest is you move blood, which flushes debris and congestion and stuff away from your cells. And then the fifth thing is your cells need good protection from microbes, because microbes are your cells' arch enemy. And I'm seeing connections to low-grade pathogens that we pick up through life, like bacteria associated with tick-borne microbes. Those things are a real threat to us, and they're not a very visible threat because they're very stealthy.
And explain to us, Dr. Ross, exactly what are microbes? And there was another term that you used, was microbiome. Perhaps you could give a little bit more definition about microbes and microbiomes.
Microbes are, technically they were originally described as one-cellular organisms. So that includes bacteria, and a little higher up on the scale of evolution is protozoa. But there are certain fungi, single-cell yeast can be pathogens that can do us harm. So those are single-cells microorganisms, bacteria, protozoa, viruses. So viruses always get included in the mix because they act like a bacteria in a lot of ways, but they're technically not considered alive. You know, they inject themselves into a cell and basically take over the cell. But functionally, they work like any other microbe. There's even evidence that they actually came from bacteria.
Would this also include viruses?
Yes, viruses. Technically, we don't call them alive until they interject themselves into a cell. Then they act very much like a bacteria, and there's even evidence that they came from bacteria. So that question about microbiome is the microbes in a particular environment, right? So if you have a scoop full of soil, it has a lot of bacteria and viruses and all kinds of stuff in it. So the microbiome is the microbes that exist in that pile of soil. So you have soil microbiome. Within our body, we have our total microbiome, all the microbes that call our body home or reside in our body. But then we have divided sections. So we have bacteria in our gut. So we have the gut microbiome, bacteria and other microbes. We have the skin microbiome, things that exist outside our skin. We have microbes that live in our mouth. But what I've been studying is the fact that we have a lot of things that actually exist inside our tissues. So this evolving concept of a blood and tissue microbiome of microbes that are present but mostly dormant inside our cells, in our brain, in our heart, in all of our tissues, including our blood. And that's something pretty new, and it's a very interesting concept because when you look at it, it explains a lot about why chronic illness occurs.
And you just led me to my next question. So let's take it the next step, because we were talking about chronic illness. Explain, define chronic illness, and then explain the relationship between microbes and chronic illness. What's that relationship?
Chronic illness, when we're moving toward that direction, we accumulate cellular stress, and cellular stress and symptoms go hand in hand. Symptoms are the biggest indication of cellular stress in your body. If you don't have symptoms, your cellular stress is pretty low. You know, you haven't crossed that threshold. But if your cellular stress is high enough, the way that you know that is you develop a symptom. If you suddenly block off an artery in your heart, you have acutely stressed the cells in your heart because they're not getting oxygen and nutrients, and you feel it as pain and you lose that function, then that's pretty intense cellular stress. But even if you wake up with a sore knee one morning, that's an indication that there's cellular stress there. Now, when we look at specific acute types of cellular stress, like a heart a blockage of a heart vessel or a broken leg, you know, acute injuries, we can really often define, well, you know, yeah, the stress was trauma that broke the leg. The stress was the blocked artery that stressed the heart cells. When you look at more chronic symptoms, there are stresses that are ongoing, but it's typically not one stress. It's a combination of bad diet and, you know, not sleeping and exposure to toxins and all of these things that kind of chronically stress our cells. Now, that microvariable, this is a new component of that model that I've been really studying for the past, I would say, decade. And it started with my journey with chronic Lyme disease of realizing that the microbes that made me ill around age 50 were actually probably present in my body and not causing any problems since I was a child. So when you look at that concept of microbiome, you have microbes that are kind of part of us, but they're not within us. And what I mean by that is our gut microbiome, the bacteria in our gut, are separated from the rest of our tissues by the intestinal barrier, the intestinal wall. The skin microbes live on the outside of our skin. We don't want them in our tissues. So everywhere that we have that presence of microbes, they're outside of our tissues. We don't want them in our tissues because the threat of microbes is our tissues are food. All living organisms are food for something else. We're basically food for bacteria. And we keep the microbes in our gut and on our skin happy by giving them a food source. You know, the microbes in our gut get the leftovers that we don't absorb from our food. And on the skin, the microbes live off of oils that we secrete to lubricate our skin. And that's dominated by microbes that we call normal flora, which are actually part of our defense system because they help suppress pathogens, threatening microbes. But we don't want them in our tissues, any of them, because if they get in our tissues, they start breaking down our cells. Well, that's actually what's happening in chronic illness. So it turns out we pick up a lot of things. People get tick bites and bug bites and mosquito bites and intimate contact with other people and respiratory infections and dog and cat bites and you know, putting things in our mouths when we're kids, and it's just endless. And every encounter, things get in our system. And sometimes we feel it. We get symptoms. But even when we don't get symptoms, some of those microbes slip past our immune system. And even the microbes in our gut, there's evidence that microbes, pathogens, are constantly crossing across from the gut into the bloodstream, from the skin into the bloodstream, from our gums into the bloodstream. And those things are slipping past the immune system, and they bury themselves in our tissues, in our cells. If our cells are healthy, they can go dormant. That's a survival mechanism. So things can go dormant, and there's evidence that that could be happening in our brain and our joints and tissues throughout our body. There's evidence that we have dormant bacteria inside of our blood cells. Everybody, healthy people. So as long as your cells are healthy, they stay quiet. Your system controls them.
And I would assume then, Dr. Walls, that this can lead to what we're talking about as far as aging. If things go awry, that the aging process can really be speeded up because of all of these things that are occurring, which you just described.
If our cells are stressed, these things can reactivate. And when they do, they start breaking down those cells and they start invading other cells. And in my opinion, that's what all chronic illnesses are. And it comes out differently with different chronic illnesses because different microbes invade different cells and we have stress in different cells. But that process of aging and the process of chronic illness, though, are separate. So we age because our cells gradually lose energy, and that's going to happen to everybody. And it's estimated that if there was absolutely no stress, if we could get through life with a perfect diet, no environmental toxins, perfect sleep, we did absolutely everything perfect for our whole lives, then we would have a cell supply that would last somewhere between 100 and 120 years. Most people don't make it that far, though, because our cells are stressed. When cells are stressed, they use more energy and they burn out their mitochondria faster. So the factors that precipitate chronic illness accelerate the cell loss that's associated with aging.
As you keep talking about the cellular level, I'm assuming that we can begin to look for solutions and healing also on the cellular level. You've already been talking about the symptoms at the cellular level, but we could also talk about healing because we want to get into herbal therapy as well. But would that be true? Not only we're talking about the issue, the problem, but the solution can also begin at the cellular level. Do you agree?
Oh, the solution always begins at the cellular level.
That then leads me to what I had also mentioned in the introduction about herbs. Again, looking at your book, you use the term herbal phytochemicals, and we need a glossary of terms here so that we understand what you're talking about. So explain what that is and how they work to cultivate wellness on the cellular level and impact and affect and heal these stress factors you've been talking about.
You know, when you look at this idea of preventing illness and slowing the process of aging by taking care of cells, by doing those acts of cellular wellness, reducing cellular stress, herbs are a really important part of that. I've made that statement, and I think it's something that's really important to recognize that those five elements, diet, toxin level, stress, mental stress, and poor sleep, inactivity, or second to that, trauma, excessive physical activity, and microbes, that's driving all chronic illness, every single bit of it. And we have different chronic illnesses because those factors, especially the microbes, come together differently in different people. So genetics plays a role in that it defines how we tolerate those stresses, but doesn't necessarily define that we will become sick in any way. But that really simplifies it down. So the opposite of that is you want a great diet. You want to clean your environment as much as you can. You want to get a decent night's sleep. You want to stay as physically active as you can be for as long as you can be. But that protection from microbes, you know, everybody knows we have our immune system, but that isn't always enough. And that's where herbs come in. And I think it's such an important variable that we're really not paying attention to. So when we talk about herbs, a lot of people think of herbs as weak versions of drugs. You know, it's like, I want something that isn't as toxic as a drug, but it's going to give me a similar kind of effect. And that's a total misconception. Drugs and herbs are like apple and oranges. They're not the same. So what you're getting out of a drug is basically something that is going to inhibit a process. You know, you've got a dysfunctional process caused by this cellular stress, and you want to stop that so you get rid of the symptom. So you want something that's going to inhibit that in some way. So that's what drugs are designed to do. And because they have this inhibiting effect, anything over that normal dosage that you're supposed to take is really a poison. So we are poisoning dysfunctional processes in our body. And there's a place for that. I think every drug has a purpose and a place, but I think we overutilize drugs. So what we're getting in with an herb is the plant's cellular protection system. So take any plant. A plant is a cellular organism, just like we are. And that plant has to protect its cells, but also regulate the functions of its cells. So when we look at a plant, it's producing this wide spectrum of chemical substances that are chemical protectants that we call phytochemicals, plant chemicals. So these chemicals have a wide range, and it's not like just a random collection of chemicals. This is a system for protecting the plant's cells against every type of bacteria, virus, protozoa, yeast, free radicals, toxic substances, harmful radiation. I mean, every variety of stress the plant is having to protect its cells. But it's also using chemicals to regulate subcellular functions, to coordinate the cells, the cellular functions in the plant so the plant can work like an organism. And a lot of those chemical messengers are very much like our hormones and chemical messengers in our body, which isn't surprising because, you know, a lot of organisms reuse some of the same things. So when we take an herb, we're basically borrowing the plant's chemical and regulatory and defense systems. So we're getting the plant's, basically the equivalent of the plant's immune system for protecting our cells against microbes, viruses, bacteria, protozoa, yeast, all of the threatening things.
I want to start getting into the different categories that you listed in your book of herbs. But I did want to just verify, are there ever situations where herbs and drugs could work together to treat chronic illness?
Yeah, I think there, every situation, herbs and drugs can work together. And it's just this wonderful resource we're not using or not utilizing to their full extent. And I think everybody looks at it like, okay, we've got herbs and we've got drugs, and maybe we want to try to replace the drugs because they're more toxic with herbs. And again, they're totally different. And because they're working by totally different mechanisms, yeah, you can use them together. I typically do. Somebody walks in to an office with a blood pressure of 200 over 110, you know, they could die of a stroke. I'm going to give them a drug to bring down that blood pressure. But at the same time, I'm going to give them herbs to normalize their vascular system and protect the cells in their vascular system.
Let's learn more about herbs, because I think oftentimes our listeners aren't quite sure what they are, which ones are good ones, which ones are bad. So again, you had divided herbs into three different categories: the green zone, the yellow zone, and the red zone. So the green zone seems to be the biggest one. There are four herbs in there, which you entitled food plants, everyday herbs, antimicrobial herbs, and herbs with targeted actions. What do you mean by that?
When you look at plants, there's a pretty wide spectrum out there. So far, what I've been talking about are herbs specifically and what I define as the green zone. But when you look at plants, you have a spectrum that extends from our food plants and culinary herbs all the way to plants that have very poisonous properties. It's like nobody would make the mistake of eating poison ivy as for health benefits, right? So that plant actually has poisonous substances in it. And very interestingly, about half our drugs actually come from plants. And everybody thinks, oh, well, we're pulling our drugs from these medicinal herbs that humans have been using for all these years. Nope. We're pulling our drugs from plants that are technically poisonous. And we're trying to get that one substance that is actually quite toxic and use it at therapeutic levels to block some reaction in the body. Yeah, it's true. So when you look at that spectrum, at one end you have your food plants, which pretty much don't have any harmful properties, all the way to the other end. And as you move toward that ends of plants that are poisonous, you start creeping into plants that have more drug-like properties. So herbs with drug-like properties, I consider in the yellow zone. So there are some herbs that their risk of side effects is relatively low compared to herbs like St. John's wort. It's going to have a very specific targeted effect. It actually works very much like drugs for depression, and it has chemicals that do have drug-like effects. But in because of that, it has more side effects too. And then all the way out to the red zone of things that most herbalists would never use, that maybe a long time ago, doctors used to use because they didn't have drugs, because they wanted that more targeted, specific blocking effect. That green zone, though, are herbs that really don't have chemicals that have drug-like effects. So you're not going to use them and, you know, you're not going to take that herb and then suddenly 2 hours later, you feel an effect from it. Basically, what they're doing is protecting ourselves from all of those factors I mentioned, including some that are very good for protecting us from our own that could potentially harm us and ourselves. So taking these things on a daily basis is something that is definitely something to consider, and I even highly recommend it. So those green zone herbs are herbs that don't have drug-like effects. You're not going to feel an immediate effect that you like you would with a drug. They're protecting your cells. And because they don't have drug-like or poisonous effects, you can take them on a daily basis.
And so give examples of each one, as I mentioned, the food plants, everyday herbs, antimicrobial herbs, and herbs with targeted actions. Can you help us understand a little bit more of what each of these might be?
So some of the more common ones that people would know are culinary herbs and spices. And top of the list in that one that probably everybody's heard of is turmeric. So turmeric is is responsible for the yellow color in an Indian curry. And turmeric is consumed at a very high level by the Indian population. And it's thought that the turmeric in the curry, people in India eat about a gram of turmeric every day. And it's thought to be one of the big reasons why they have such a low risk of Alzheimer's and cancer. It has potent anti-inflammatory effects, and that's because it's protecting cells really intensely. It has some antimicrobial effects too, so it helps balance our microbiome, the entire microbiome of the body. So taking turmeric every day is pretty low risk. Most people can do turmeric. Herbs that we define as adaptogens are herbs that have the effect of reducing stress hormones in addition to protecting our cells, and it's because of the types of chemicals they contain. One well-known is ginseng. I don't use ginseng a lot because it is a little bit too stimulating for most people, but there is another one called rhodiola. It is native to Siberia, but it's actually has been found in the Appalachian Mountains of North America. So plants get around, and there are a lot of similar plants all over the earth. We also have our medicinal mushrooms. So a lot of mushrooms have favorable properties that are very good for us. So there's just a long, long list of these herbs in the green zone that can be taken every day that we really should be paying more attention to in our society.
I would now ask you, obviously, you are a physician who used to provide clinical care and now are more of an advocate of this alternative therapy. Are there certain types of healthcare providers that are likely to advocate for and recommend use of this herbal protocol that you're talking about for healing?
If you're looking for someone who might know something about herbs, it would be a naturopath. And naturopaths get a similar training to medical doctors, except they are more schooled in natural therapies. They're not available in all states. Some states don't license them, but in states that they can be licensed, they can also write prescriptions, and they use drugs. They just tend to don't use them very much. So naturopaths are really good for that. There are exceptions. There are medical doctors out there that are at least advocating or recognizing the value of herbs. I'm trying to change that as quickly as I can, as much as I can. But quite frankly, our education systems are very fixed toward our current model of treating dysfunction in the body with medical therapies. That has great value when it comes to acute intervention. We do a great job with acute intervention. You break your leg, you have a heart attack, you have some kind of sudden event. We have the right tools to do that. And for even even a chronic illness in the acute stages, like that high case of high blood pressure that I mentioned, using medications to stabilize that can really prevent something bad from happening. So all of these interventions are very important. It's just that when we look at chronic illness, we're applying all of those tools for acute intervention to a chronic situation, and we're just basically ignoring the precipitating causes so people don't get well. 60% of our population right now is defined as being chronically ill. 60%. And that's not just a specific age group. That's everybody.
As long as we're talking, you mentioned now, of course, these different types of herbs, but you also hear about herbal supplements. Help us understand a little bit more about the difference, say, between herbs that you might get out of your garden versus herbal supplements, because we often hear about the quality. These aren't regulated. What about potency or purity or synergy in terms of in the body? And I think the other thing is even the dosage. I mean, is one the right amount or should we take more? How can people who decide that they want to take herbal supplements, should they, and what should they know?
It's one of the reasons that I wrote the book, just to clear up a lot of misconceptions. And the herbal industry actually is well regulated. The problem is the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, is designed to regulate drugs, and they try to regulate herbs like they regulate drugs, and it just doesn't work. They don't understand what they're regulating, basically. So there are a lot of regulations, but the regulations don't work very well, and they don't have the bandwidth to really define how the regulation should be administered. So that's frustrating for a lot of different companies, and it leaves room for a lot of unscrupulous companies to really take advantage of that. If you're growing herbs in your garden, which I encourage people to do, having the availability of herbs is really nice, but it tends to be very, very seasonal, and getting the full concentration of things that you really need to have a medicinal effect, it's just really, really hard to do growing your own herbs. And especially because when you combine herbs from different places, you get different properties. So a plant is building out a chemical defense system and regulatory system for the environment that it is in. So whatever microbe stress and other kinds of stresses it has in its particular environment, that's what it's building out for. So if you're taking plants from different parts of the world, you're getting, or different regions in the world, you're getting a wider spectrum. The one thing about herbs is we typically use formulas that can contain four or even a dozen herbs because they have a synergistic effect. You know, they complement each other. So getting that, raising that in your garden, being able to get that year-round is really, really hard. So most of us, me included, turn to commercial preparations to get the level of phytochemistry that's really going to make a difference. And some of that, you know, you can do dried herbs and a tea, but you're only getting one spectrum of the chemicals. So you want to get the whole plant. You want to get everything, the full spectrum of the chemicals in the plant. There are three main commercial preparations for herbs. One is a whole herb powder. And if you go to a grocery store or a health food store and you're paying about $15 for a bottle of herbs that are in capsules, so what you're getting there is they take the plant, whatever the active plant part of the plant is, whether that's leaves and stems or roots or whatever, and they dry the plant and crush it up into a powder and put it in the capsule. Now, the problem with that is you're getting mostly fiber. You're not getting much of the phytochemistry, and that's why it might only cost $15 or $20. And that's what a lot of herbal supplements are. And what you see very often is a lot of hype on a website, but you'll be getting that basic herbal powder and it's not going to be doing very much. So I always tell people, read the label. And if you can't find the ingredients, you know, you go to a website and there's lots of convincing information, but you can't find anything about what's actually in the product, that's a big red flag. Run away from that. So the next level up is what we call tinctures. So we take the plant and put it into a water alcohol solution. And that water alcohol solution pulls the full spectrum of the chemicals from the plant. Then we discard the plant parts because we don't want all that fiber. We just want the chemistry of the plant. The tincture is liquid. You get it in a little bottle and you take a dropper full of the tincture. So you're getting just the chemistry of the plant in that water alcohol mixture. The downside of that is a lot of herbs are very bitter. Some people, now I like to try different herbs, but a lot of people don't. And to really get the levels of the phytochemistry that you want, especially if you're using them therapeutically to overcome some kind of condition, then you're taking a lot of water and alcohol to get the benefits. So the next step beyond that is what's called a standardized extract. And that's kind of the gold standard, in my opinion. Not to say that all the other products aren't great. I use some of everything. But a standardized extract, they take the water alcohol tincture, spray it on a surface, dry off the water and alcohol, and collect the powder. And that goes into a capsule. But it's the pure chemistry of the plant. So when you look at a whole herb powder and a standardized extract powder, you know, you compare the capsules side by side, they look the same. But the standardized extract is typically 10 times more potent than that whole herb powder. And the way to know that is if you look on the bottle or you look on the website, instead of just seeing the name like Japanese knotweed, what you're going to see is Japanese knotweed. You're going to see the scientific name. You're going to see that it's standardized to X phytochemical. So they'll list a chemical. They'll list the ratio or the percentage that it's standardized to, and you'll get a milligram quantity. Now you're talking about something that actually is going to do something. It has enough concentration to matter. And then beyond that, testing is the way to know whether the product is actually good enough. So for our company, all of the extracts that we use come with a third-party certificate of analysis. So the supplier has paid for an analysis to define that it is the correct plant and it doesn't have bacterial, heavy metal, or organic contaminants in the product. Or it has, you know, it's low enough that it's acceptable. It's hard to get zero. But we're not satisfied with that. We take a sample from that lot and actually have it tested by our own lab independently to make sure the certificate of analysis was actually real. And then we have it tested several times during the mixing and manufacturing process to get those capsules. A lot of companies are doing that. Most companies are not. So finding reputable companies, and it's a matter of just doing research and looking on the website and asking questions.
And to that point, one of the things that I was wondering, Dr. Rawls, is if there are like websites that provide information, since this program goes all over the country. You mentioned, I was going to step back for a moment when you talked about naturalists as the best health provider that might advocate for herbal protocol. But are there certain websites that now somebody could look up to learn more about a naturalist in their area? Or what you had just said a moment ago about doing research about the companies that are reputable and trustworthy. Can you tell us more?
Part of it, unfortunately, it is a little bit doing your own research. You know, as a company that I've been working with quality and herbal supplements for over 15 years now. And the problem is there are certifying agencies out there. It's like, you know, I can pay money to be part, to be certified with this agency, and they basically send you a questionnaire and say, are you doing these things? And you send it back and they give you this certification. So, but they're really expensive. That's a lot of cost to the product. Companies like ours, we don't use them because it would increase the cost. I would rather put that money into the testing and the things that really do matter. So that can be a frustration. Most all of the manufacturers in the country now are good manufacturing processes, certified GMP. I think part of it is just the company itself making the decisions to do that level of testing and to supply that quality. And that's generally a company standard. What I would encourage people to do is spend time getting to know a company and their standards and, you know, what they believe in as far as the products they put out.
Any thoughts? Of course, you can also go into any drugstore or a health food store and you can see some of these products that you've been mentioning. Is that also a good way to, you know, decide that that's the best way to purchase something? Or is it important even to do research to make sure that the products that are in your local drugstore or health food store are also reputable?
Most things that I would find in a drugstore, I wouldn't buy. First of all, the quality is going to be really low. I've never bought an herbal product from a pharmacy. And if you have a local health food store, you're going to be a little bit better. And that especially if you get to know the people at the store, they might be able to help guide you. And they're going to have a tendency to carry higher products. Even the big outfits like Whole Foods are going to be better. But, you know, I've found bad products in places like that too. So the standard does vary. I think most people getting to know a company that you feel comfortable with and researching that company, whether you're buying it through a health food store or whether you're ordering it online, you know, just having that personal feel with the people creating the products, I think is really important.
One thing I did want to ask you that you had mentioned in your book called Foundational Everyday Herbs. What does that mean? What are examples of that? And I also was wondering, are there any side effects to those? What did you mean by that?
I always hedge my bets and say that anybody could have a bad reaction to any herb, but the chances of that are very, very, very low. And when I just say foundational herbs, it's herbs that we would take on a daily basis, year-round, ongoing, to protect our health, but protect ourselves. And I mentioned some of those, like our adaptogens, like reishi and rhodiola, and anti-inflammatory herbs like turmeric. So you know, there's that basic spectrum of herbs that I think are reasonable for every person to take on a daily basis that have a low potential to cause harm, that could be taken long term, that are going to overall have a beneficial effect. When we look at this idea, it's really replacing something that I think has gone missing. If I had to define the biggest deficiency in our modern diet, it would be phytochemicals, not vitamins, not nutrients. We're getting basic vitamins. We'd die if we didn't. We're getting that from even our worst diet. But we're not getting these protective phytochemicals, and we have been for all time. So when you look at our ancient history, for hundreds of thousands of years, humans ate a foraged food diet. And I think, you know, you occasionally hear, oh, they were eating lots of meat. But all the scientific evidence is that they weren't. In most locations on Earth, humans were eating about two-thirds plant matter. And then the rest was wild meat, but it wasn't just the meat. It was basically all of the animal. And they were getting a lot of phytochemicals. Lots of phytochemicals because they were eating wild plants. and they were eating stems and roots and leaves and wild berries and all of these things. And they ate a lot of it because wild forage food didn't have what our current diet has, which is too much calories. So they had to eat a lot of food to get enough calories to survive. So as a byproduct, they were getting literally tons of phytochemicals. Average human, several hundred thousand years ago, ate an average of 500 different plants in a year. We might eat a dozen or two. That's it. And then, you know, so about 10,000 years ago, we started moving toward an agriculture, toward farming food. And what we farmed were grains, because grains could be stored and, you know, they packed a lot of calories. They had what the forage food didn't have. Beans and grain have a lot of calories. But what they don't have is that phytochemistry. So 10,000 years ago, we started giving up that rich history of our phytochemistry and replacing it with calories. And that's the difference in herbs and our food as we know it today, our plants. Even our vegetables are cultivated to produce calories, not protective phytochemicals. So we've trained our plants to produce calories. We don't stress our plants. We try to keep them unstressed so they'll produce lots and lots of calories. And our cultivated plants have given up the ability to protect themselves. That's why we have to use so much pesticide and herbicide in our food. So they don't, and I'm not suggesting that broccoli and celery and those kinds of vegetables aren't good for you. They're great for you. But they don't have the protective chemistry, the concentration of phytochemicals that their wild counterparts once had. So that's a big deficiency in our diet. And the fact that most people don't eat vegetables and are eating just grain and beans and meat, wow, is that an enormous deficiency? Well, 10,000 years ago, they kind of, okay, yeah, we're changing here, but they kept that herbal tradition. They kept that phytochemistry in their diet by eating culinary herbs and medicinal herbs. So that was very much a part of human culture worldwide. We stopped that about 100 years ago when we traded all of our herbs and our phytochemistry for drugs and processed foods, and we've been suffering for it ever since.
Well, we're getting close to the end of the interview, but I did want you to just briefly explain what you meant by sustainable lifestyle habits. And I liked the verbs that you used, nourish, purify, calm, move, and defend. If you could just briefly talk, and I know there was a lot more in your book, but just explain how those also are central to promoting cellular wellness.
You know, it gets back to those five factors of what your cells need. And when you look at giving yourselves, you know, most of our eating habits are driven toward consuming calories because that's what our brain tells us we need. And that's what was deficient in those ancient forage food diets. So we focus on calories instead of nourishment for our cells. Our cells just don't need much carbohydrate and fat. They really run lean. And you eat too much carbohydrate and fat, you know, it just overpowers the cell, and it's just really bad for us. So a clean diet is really important. So my parameters for a good diet, a healthy diet, are first, whole foods as much as you possibly can. Whole foods are whole cells, so they're going to have all the parts of the cells that come in the food are going to give your nourish all your cells. So a whole apple has carbohydrate, but all that carbohydrate is contained inside cells. A donut is pure carbohydrate and fat extracted from seeds. It doesn't have those cellular parts and those other nutrients in it that are so important. So whole food diet, more vegetables than anything else. You know, that's a hard one to ask people to do. People have a hard, they struggle with vegetables, but every day I try to get in more vegetables than anything else. And then I kind of divide everything up evenly. I do eat meat. I eat some grains, but most of my diet, half my diet is vegetable. cutting those carbs. I try to keep my carbs down below about 150 grams a day. That's really important. So, you know, I eat some oatmeal from time to time, and I'll occasionally have a piece of pizza, but I try not to go over that limit every day. Toxins, toxic environment. Our environment is very toxic, but we can protect ourselves. So toxins, there are only three ways that toxic substances can get in your body. You can breathe them, you can consume them, or you can rub them on your skin. That's it. So you can eat organic food. That cuts out a lot of bad stuff. You can filter your water. That's really easy to do. Air is a little tougher. So making sure you have clean air inside your home, air filters, not using petroleum-based chemicals a lot inside your home as much as you can, low VOC paints, etc., to improve your indoor air quality. Outdoors, being where there is nature. The cleanest air on earth is over open water and inside forest. And if you're surrounded by trees, especially trees that don't burn down, you're going to have cleaner air. Skin products, just using natural skin products and paying a little more instead of petroleum-based. Everything you find in the pharmacy, including all the drugs, is petroleum-based. Yes, all of our drugs come from petroleum. Getting 8 hours of sleep a night, really important. We all ought to shoot for that. Sometimes it's hard to do, but we should. And just moving every day is so important to increase blood flow. And finally, just being smart. I mean, we were all smart about microbes for a couple of years during COVID, and now we're kind of right back to where we were. And just smart practices are not about not picking up microbes, because they are everywhere.
Any final comments that you would like to share? Any repeat of the resources that you mentioned and about your book?
The big thing is, it doesn't matter where you are or what your health status is, there is always room for improvement. You know, symptoms, disease are absolutely related to cellular stress. You do these things to reduce cellular stress and you can reverse a lot. Now, there are limits to that. You know, we are burning out cells every day and you only have so many cells to work with, but you keep your cells healthy, you're going to have a better life. You're going to be able to extract more out of life for the years that you are here. And that is really important.
I want to thank Dr. Bill Rawls, who, again, leading expert in integrative health and author of the book called The Cellular Wellness Solution. Thank you so much, Dr. Rawls, for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Well, I want to also remind our listeners that if you want to learn more about Aging Matters, you can visit our website, which is agingmattersonline.com. Of course, at that site, you can access all of the Aging Matters radio programs that we've produced, also the TV show content, and, of course, the Aging Matters podcasts, which are on Apple, Spotify, and Red Circle. So again, agingmattersonline.com. Aging Matters is produced in association with Steve Lack Audio. To learn more about that company, visit stevelackaudio.com. Thank you for listening to Aging Matters today. And remember, age is just a number, not a label. I'll be back again with you next week. Seabury Resources for Aging is a proud partner of Aging Matters. As a nonprofit, Seabury serves older adults in the Washington, D.C. region and across the United States with its care management model to support caregivers and their loved ones. Seabury is a pioneer in the field of services for older adults, providing affordable housing and support services to help older adults age in place. For more information, visit their website, seaburyresources.org, or call them at 202-289-5690.